Hello and welcome to Science World. A scientist searching for the origin of flowering plants says the earliest flower to bloom did so during a period when dinosaurs roamed the earth. NASA lifts its controversial ban on the participation of Chinese scientists at a scientific conference in California next month. And we talk with one of the authors of a new book that chronicles some of the most important unmanned space missions of the last 50 years. This and much more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. We begin with a scientist searching for the origin of flowering plants that evolved to dominate our landscape. As Roseanne Skirbel reports, the scientist's findings push back the date of the earliest flower by 100 million years, back to the period of time when dinosaurs roamed the Earth.
25 years ago, geologist Peter O'Hooley was on an expedition in Norway when he made a discovery in a sediment core that puzzled him.
And there I found first these amazing pollen grains, which looked to me like the ones I knew from the Cretaceous.
That's the relatively warm geological period, 140 million years ago, when dinosaurs dominated the landscape, and scientists believe new groups of mammals and birds, as well as flowering plants, appeared. The problem was that he had dated the core to the Triassic, or 100 million years earlier, in Earth's history.
But for many of my colleagues, it doesn't fit the pictures that these pollen are occur in the Middle Triassic. So I thought they were contaminants. And I suspected that they came from the lab. In the lab, they also prepared Cretaceous sediments. So I thought that they made kind of a mess.
But he doesn't think so anymore. Now a paleobotanist at the University of Zurich, O'Hooley has focused his research on finding the origin of flowering plants, which evolved from extinct plants related to today's conifers, seed ferns, and pollen. O'Hooley works with organic fossils, those leaves, woody particles, spores, and pollen extracted from sediment cores. His new study in the journal Frontiers in Plant Science describes pollen extracted from sediment cores in Switzerland. Interestingly, the date is consistent with his earlier suspicions more than two decades ago.
I think it's the direct line of in the evolution of flowering plants. We are sure that the assemblages of the pollen and spores we found, they're about 240 million years old.
The finding extends the uninterrupted sequence of fossilized pollen from flowers by 100 million years. O'Hooley says his previous study in 2004 documented different but clearly related flowering plant-like pollen from the Barents Sea, some 4,800 kilometers away.
And I think they are more widespread and more common than we originally thought. Originally, we thought that this Barents Sea area would be kind of the cradle of the flowering plant evolution. But that's certainly not the case.
Charles Darwin described the origin of plants as an abominable mystery because they appeared to spread across the Earth in such a relatively short time. While O'Hooley's work pushes the date back, he says gaps remain and the record is spotty.
I'm searching for the roots and searching for a group of plants, or I'm searching for plants which are at the base of the flowering plants.
O'Hooley says more fossil evidence is needed to confirm his findings, a task he has committed his life to find. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
You could say that telemedicine has been around with us for a long time, back to when African villagers used smoke signals to warn people to stay away from the village in case of serious disease. But today, the use of telecommunications to provide clinical health care at a distance has risen to new levels of accessibility. Tom Bonsi has more.
Picture this. You're at home with a bad cold, aching face, and green mucus leaking from your nose. You can barely get out of bed, let alone get to a clinic. That was Diana Ray's actual predicament recently. The nurse educator from the small town of Tenino, Washington, called a doctor and described her symptoms and eventually got a prescription. But as she demonstrates, she could have talked to and been seen by a doctor from the comfort of home. That's a Wi-Fi connected iPad running the free video chat software Skype.
Hi, yes, my name's Dr. Ben Green. I'm one of the doctors here with Franciscan Virtual Urgent Care.
Dr. Green has Ray describe her symptoms, then the difference video chat makes. The doctor performs a physical exam by mimicking what he wants his patient to do.
Push on your cheeks, and push on them quite firmly, and tell me if that's causing you any pain, discomfort. Is that tender?
Well, over here on the right side, it's not so bad, but over here on the left, it's sore, and very sore right here.
And then Dr. Green diagnoses a sinus infection and is able to prescribe an antibiotic. He says about 75% of the time, the patient's ailment can be treated remotely like this.
Patient safety is really important to us, so if we feel like the patient is not safe to be treated in this manner, we're going to suggest other alternatives for them.
Tacoma, Washington-based Franciscan Health System charges $35 for the virtual house call, much cheaper than going to an emergency room, a doctor's office, or an urgent care clinic for something that requires immediate attention. After trying out the video conference, Diana Ray says she'd pay the $35.
I would have paid twice that for the convenience of getting taken care of without having to sit in a waiting room, wait, get exposed to everyone else's germs.
Franciscan, which runs hospitals, clinics, and a hospice, contracted with telehealth company Carina to add virtual urgent care delivered via Skype or phone. Carina is one of several companies doing this around the country. But an executive there laments that state regulations haven't kept pace with telemedicine. The virtual urgent care staff must be separately licensed in each state where it does business, which means, for now, Carina doctors can diagnose and treat in Washington State and California, for example, but not in neighboring Oregon and Idaho. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Tacoma, Washington.
The U.S. space agency NASA says that it has lifted a controversial ban on the participation of Chinese scientists at a scientific conference in California next month. Science World's Bob Doty has the story.
In an email sent to VOA this past week, NASA said scientists of Chinese origin who initially were excluded from applying to attend the Kepler Science Conference at NASA's Ames Research Center next month now are able to apply. The U.S. Space Agency says its initial decision to bar access to the Chinese scientists was unfortunate and based on a misinterpretation of government policy. Earlier this month, a group of academics organizing the conference said they reluctantly denied the registrations of six Chinese nationals because of a NASA moratorium. The organizers said the U.S. Space Agency banned visits to NASA facilities by citizens of China and several other nations in March, when a new U.S. law took effect. The law restricts foreign access to NASA facilities due to national security concerns. The organizers said they only learned about the NASA ban in late September and denounced the legal restrictions behind it as deplorable. Some scientists had said they would boycott the conference to protest the exclusion of the Chinese academics. NASA says the policy concerning foreign access to its facilities was clarified and the decision corrected once the federal government reopened last Thursday after a 16-day partial shutdown. China had accused NASA of discriminatory behavior for the earlier decision to bar the scientists. It said Beijing believes that academic or scientific research activities should not be politicized. For Science World, this is Bob Doty.
It's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. A little later in our program, we'll be talking with a co-author of a new book about unmanned space missions. So today, we want to know the name of the first space probe to send back close-up pictures of the Martian surface. Was it A, Mariner 4, B, Zond 2, or C, Viking 1? Think about it and see if you can come up with the right answer. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
As smartphone usage grows in South Africa, companies are tapping into the technology. Peter Cox reports from Johannesburg on the growing market for smartphone apps.
There's a new app in Johannesburg that takes the phone out of ordering a taxi, or at least the phone call. SnapCab allows users to hail a cab with a tap of a screen. Such smartphone technology has unlocked a new way to do business across the world, and in South Africa, companies are starting to tackle local problems with phone applications. And more frequently, customers here are making transactions with their phones. Anton van Metzinger is the managing director of SnapCab. He and two partners launched their cab hailing app in mid-September. On a Johannesburg street, he described how the app works.
You open the app and you literally, with two clicks of a button, you can order a cab. Using your GPS, you click the button, you electronically hail the cab. It connects you to the closest cabs in the area. So I get the cab driver's name, I get the cab driver's company that he or she works for, their vehicle registration details, and the vehicle description. So I know, as the passenger, I know exactly which cab is coming to me, and I can now track it on my smartphone.
When the cab arrives, the passenger gets an alert. When the ride is done, the passenger can pay by cash, or, as a growing number of the customers are doing, paying through their smartphone.
We've been in the market only for about a month now, and we already see that the credit card payment option is very popular. In fact, more popular than we expected initially. People are getting used to the idea of online shopping. They're getting used to the idea of mobile, certainly mobile shopping, using their phones or their tablets to access the world and to access retailers. We predict that a year down the line or so, the majority of our transactions will probably be by credit card.
There are an estimated 14.7 million smartphones registered with South African telecom networks. That number is bound to grow as smartphone prices drop below $100 in the local market and as South African technology companies aim to launch smartphones of their own. But this country hasn't exactly jumped headfirst into making transactions through smartphone applications compared to some other African nations. Arthur Goldstuck, managing director of Worldwide Works, is an author and journalist who specializes in South African technology. He says the marketplace has to mature.
It's still at a very early stage in this country. By and large, South African consumers are not yet ready to make a purchase on their phone.
Goldstuck says people don't trust or have confidence using their phones to make purchases until they are well-versed in the phone's interface and technology. He says that trust can take years to build.
There's a phenomenon in this country and probably across Africa that we call the digital participation curve, and it shows that the average internet user needs to have been online for 5 years or more before they're ready to start transacting online.
But there have already been success stories here. PowerTime is an app that was launched in 2009 to sell prepaid electricity. Prior to the app, power users here would have to go to a fueling station or grocery store to buy prepaid electricity.
What I find that is working in South Africa is if you build an app that is relevant to the country because it solves a local problem. So kind of a local app for a local problem. And I think that was part of the success of PowerTime. It was a very, very significant issue in South Africa to buy prepaid electricity.
Sebastian Lacour is the managing director of PowerTime, which has built a base of 17,000 users. He says the success of an app also depends on making the process easy for the user.
You must make the payment process as quick and simple as possible, because you can't ask a user to enter his credit card detail on his cell phone. So you need the ability to store credit card details. So I think this is a key feature to any successful mobile app, the ability to have a one-step purchase, basically.
With a solid group of regular customers, PowerTime has now moved into paying other utilities, municipal bills, and phone airtime, as well as helping small businesses set up their payment systems through their websites and their phones. Peter Cox for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Scientists have found a possible answer to an age-old question: why do we sleep? As Carol Pearson reports, the answer may lead to new treatments for neurological disorders such as Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease.
While we're sleeping, our brains are doing much more than recharging for the next day, according to researchers at the University of Rochester. Our brains may be flushing away harmful waste. Researchers studied the brains of mice that had fluorescent dye injected into their cerebral spinal fluid. This is what they saw. Notice the amount of activity in the brain scan on the left. That mouse is asleep. On the right is a scan of a mouse brain when the animal is awake. Neurologist Maiken Niedergaard led the study. She says our brains have two very distinct functions.
When we are awake, the brain cells are working very hard at processing all the information about our surroundings, whereas during sleep, really work very, very hard on removing all the waste that build up when we are awake.
The researchers say that waste includes toxins responsible for Alzheimer's disease and other neurological disorders. They also found that during sleep, the brain cells shrink, allowing waste to be removed more effectively. Dr. Niedergaard says the waste ends up in the liver, where the toxins are broken down.
So our study suggests that we need to sleep because we have a macroscopic cleaning system that removes many of the toxic waste products from the brain.
The brain's cleaning system could only be studied with new imaging technologies because the test animal must be alive in order to see this process. Dr. Niedergaard says the next step is to look for the process in human brains. These results highlight the important role that sleep plays in health and disease, and may one day lead to treatments to prevent or reverse neurological disorders. Carol Pearson, VOA News.
Do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Let's find out. This week, we wanted to know the name of the first space probe to send back close-up pictures of the Martian surface. Was it A, Mariner 4, B, Zond 2, or C, Viking 1? Well, the answer is A. The Mariner 4 was launched in November 1964 and was part of a series of U.S. unmanned planetary exploratory spacecraft. It performed the first successful flyby of the planet Mars and sent back the first close-up pictures of the Martian surface. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Over the last 50 years or so, there have been a number of unmanned spacecraft that have been sent to explore space. From the early probes that were sent to the Moon, Mars, and Venus, to today's Curiosity rover that's been exploring the surface of Mars, to the Hubble Space Telescope that has taken us to nearly the beginning of the universe. A new book called Dreams of Other Worlds, The Amazing Story of Unmanned Space Exploration, reflects on some of the most remarkable and iconic space missions. It's written by Chris Impey from the University of Arizona and Holly Henry from California State University, San Bernardino. Probes have been sent into space since the beginning of the space age. What are some of the probes that you consider to be the most notable that have been launched since the late 1950s?
Well, I think it divides into the probes that we sent through the solar system at this point, pretty much reaching every major target. And those are, you know, heroic decade-long journeys over a billion miles or more. They're sort of testaments to our technology that we can do that, including landing on worlds that are that far away. And then the other set of probes really are the ones in orbit that are looking through the universe, often right back to the beginning of time, our sort of space telescopes and our observing platforms in Earth orbit. And those, you know, two sets of space probes have, you know, they've told us an enormous amount about the universe we live in.
Let's get into some of the unmanned exploratory spacecraft that you and Dr. Henry wrote about. The first was Viking. Tell us about that.
Viking is extraordinary because it's a, you know, it's 1960s technology, and yet it did these, it was a twin orbiter, a twin lander, you know, completely technically successful mission, and, you know, tried to detect life on Mars with something we actually still haven't done since, because Curiosity is on the surface right now, and the scientists involved are very careful to say it's not a life detection experiment. So Viking was sort of like hitting for the fences, to use a sports metaphor. And although it returned sort of ambiguous results on the life detection, you know, it was an extremely ambitious and an audacious mission, I would say.
Since the Viking program, especially in the last 10 years, exploration of Mars has taken off with a number of spacecraft sent to the Red Planet. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the more important probes that have been sent to study the planet Mars?
Yes. I mean, there are some that are not maybe as well known to the public. HiRISE, which is an orbiting telescope that is taking, you know, exquisite pictures of the entire surface with a resolution of about a meter, so it can see pretty much anything smaller than a chair. That's a sort of pathfinding mission, because if we ever send landers or rovers or humans to Mars, we'll need to know a lot of detail about the terrain, and it's teaching us a lot about the geology. So the orbiters have done some amazing things and are maybe not as well known as the rovers. You know, the Spirit and Opportunity are extraordinary because they're tiny little go-kart-sized rovers. One is now deceased after almost a decade, but they were only designed to last 90 days. And they've essentially, you know, put in a box and tied a ribbon around it the story of Mars as a formerly wet and habitable planet that subsequently dried out and lost its atmosphere. So they haven't found water on the surface because it can't be on the surface right now. And they didn't find life because they weren't designed to find life. But they've really shown how Mars has been habitable in the past and indeed might be habitable under the surface right now.
One spacecraft that was launched in the 1970s and has continued to send back valuable data since, that it's made history recently. It's Voyager 1. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Voyagers and the Pioneers are amazing spacecraft. Voyager, these are the objects, our first messages in a bottle, if you like, things that we've tossed out of the solar system into the void of interstellar space. And that's an incredible achievement. And, you know, it takes decades for something to truly leave the solar system, which is to say, you know, well beyond the orbit of Neptune and Pluto, to the place where the sun's influence basically wanes and you're in interstellar space. And the fact that these missions still can transmit data or have any power after 35, 40 years is remarkable. And the fact that they've endured that long is remarkable. Now, Voyager has the extra little twist that it has a message to the rest of the universe, if you like, or aliens that might find it. I'm more tongue-in-cheek, because it has a record, a long-playing record.
Yeah, the gold record.
The gold record, right. Yeah. And the scientists who designed that, they got a little flack because people said, well, you know, you're sending out a technology into space to show the aliens how smart we are that's not even used on Earth anymore. They pushed back, I think, rightly against that, because they pointed out that our digital technologies like CDs and DVDs, we actually have no idea how long they'll last, and there's signs that they're already degrading, whereas this analog technology they sent will endure for millennia.
Let's look into the future. What projects are on the drawing board, and what will be sent into space in the years to come? What can we expect?
Well, the big one for astronomers is JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope. It's the successor to Hubble. Hubble is, you know, long in the tooth, but it's been rejuvenated by all the servicing missions. However, it, you know, with some indeterminate timescale of a couple of years from now, it's going to lose its gyros or its power capability, and it will die a natural death. And JWST sort of upped the ante because it's at a Lagrange point, so it's not a low Earth orbit. You can't service it. It's got to work, and that's the end of the story because you can't fix it. It's 6.5 meters in diameter instead of 2.2 meters, so it's much more collecting area. And it's, you know, got the ambitious mission of trying to look at the first light in the universe, trying to sniff the atmospheres of exoplanets to see tracers of life. It's got some very ambitious science goals.
That was Chris Impey from the University of Arizona in Tucson. He, along with co-author Holly Henry from California State University, San Bernardino, have written a new book, Dreams of Other Worlds, The Amazing Story of Unmanned Space Exploration. The book has been published by Princeton University Press. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.